It's been a chaotic fortnight for European leadership. France fired and then rehired its prime minister. Germany's coalition has shown some major cracks. And former German defense minister Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg has caused a major stir. Meanwhile, the Chinese Navy has taken some important steps. And sadly, the war in Ukraine continues, and we have to keep you up to date with developments there. We're going to look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Hello and welcome back to Trumpet World. We've had a great couple of weeks. We've been running a slightly different schedule for the last little bit as all of our editors and contributors travel for the Feast of Tabernacles. But there's a load of world events that have happened during this time. And so now we're back, or rather some of us are. And so we're going to update you on what's been going on while we've been off the air. We've got a lot to cover. And so we're going to do that in a couple of special episodes. Today, Jeremiah Jacques and I have recorded segments covering the most important news from Europe and Asia. And then for Wednesday's show, we're going to have the same thing from Andrew and Simon. Of course, a lot of big events have been going on in the Middle East, for example. So stick around till Wednesday. We'll talk about the Donald Trump peace deal and eternal peace in Gaza. Is that what we've got here? And we'll look more at that then, and we'll get the Middle East and then also the English-speaking world from Andrew Miller. But government chaos, that's the best way that I can summarize Europe's news. You've got all kinds of disarray in European government. And again, it's quite the contrast to this time of year, this holy day season that we've been off celebrating, that points us forwards to the time when God's government will be established on the earth and all of the unity and the order and just well-organized and perfectly running government that will be coming soon to the whole planet. Well, we've had anything but that, particularly in France, while we've been off the air. So on October 5th, France's new Prime Minister, Sébastien Lecornu, he announced his new cabinet, and then the next day he resigned. He had lasted just 27 days, making his time in office the shortest in modern French history. He gave up. He said, you know, he can't make any progress with the divisions within the German parliament, and parliament had no confidence in him. Lecornu, he's just the latest in a succession of failed French prime ministers, setting new records about being short-lived. You have this parliament split basically between the far left, and you've got various different brands of socialism there. You've got the center right, and then you've got the far right, as they're generally termed, formerly the National Front, and they are, they're far left in some policies as well. They're less easy to pin down than those simple labels, but we'll go with far right for now. And no one has been able to make these different branches work together. So Mr. Macron formally accepted Lecornu's resignation on that Monday, October 6th, but he asked him to stick around for two more days in a last-ditch effort to find a solution. And Lecornu kind of asked around, and then he asked for another couple of days. And all through this time, there was feverish speculation. You had people talking about France changing its constitution, coming up with a brand new constitution and declaring the sixth French Republic to try and deal with this. There were some talking about Macron basically declaring himself a dictator, invoking emergency powers under Article 16 of the Constitution. All kind of weird and wonderful ideas. But this is where we are in French politics now, where things that are kind of bizarre and unusual and off the wall are now talked about by serious journalists as, well, could this be what's next? And in some ways, what came next was even crazier than these different ideas. On Friday, October 10th, President Emmanuel Macron named Sébastien Lecornu's replacement. And the replacement for Sébastien Lecornu, who had resigned, was Sébastien Lecornu. Kind of seems an appropriate choice, I guess, for the country that gave the world surrealism. And so, Lecornu replaced himself, I guess. He reappointed after resigning. The big stumbling block that he shifted that got him back is pension reform. And it's kind of a big deal because pension reform for Emmanuel Macron has been about the most significant piece of domestic legislation that he's managed to get through. This is his biggest accomplishment. France's pensions have been broken for a long, long time, and anyone who tries to fix them is met with masses of protests, and they're defeated. But at the same time, France's budget is clearly unsustainable, and having an incredibly generous pension scheme is just not realistic. So somebody's got to do it, but anybody that tries to do it gets thrown out of office. So for Macron, but that he got pension reform done was one of his biggest achievements. Like, he was, several other presidents came along and they had their plans and they failed, but Macron succeeded. So this is not, what I'm trying to make sure we get here is this is not just a one of his many policies. It's not even just similar to, say, pension reform in a lot of these other countries. This was his signature piece of domestic legislation. And pension reform is something within the purview of Parliament and the Prime Minister in terms of this differentiation of power. But Macron, as president, was the one that really drove this through. And Le Carnu said, OK, I'm going to come back as Prime Minister and we will hit the pause button and give you the opportunity to undo Macron's pension reform. And this shows how desperate that Macron has become and his supporters have become that they would even allow this. So this was pushed on pause for a couple of years until after the next presidential election. The potential being that other parties now have a shot at if they get their guy in office, they have an opportunity to destroy the whole thing. So it's paused, but if they win that election, they could get rid of it. This puts the whole pension reform in jeopardy. So, I mean, most countries, pension age is around 66, 67. And in most countries, it's been rising because life expectancies have been rising. And the longer, the more years people live, that's great. But if the pension age remains the same, you're going to have to keep giving them pensions for longer. It's a bigger burden on the economy. France, their pension age is 62. And Macron's reforms would see it rise to 64. So still generous compared to the rest of the world. And remember, France has still got a massive budget crisis. They're borrowing around 5% of their economy completely unsustainably. But at least he increased it a couple of years. In reality, a lot of people in France retire earlier even than 62 because there's rules about maximum career lengths or maximum times that you can... serve in your job before they have to offer you retirement. And I mean, really, the French do kind of not, they have a very negative attitude towards work. I mean, they would say that that's a horribly Anglo-Saxon thing to say. It's a different view of work. So they would accuse me of being Anglo-Saxon, I guess. But it is pretty anti-work. So they tried to have in a piece of legislation that limited everybody to working 35 hours a week and no more than that, and even if you wanted to, you couldn't work more than that. It was what they were kind of going towards. They had to roll that back because it just proved so economically destructive. In France, you know, in a lot of countries, including Britain, you have a minimum paid holiday, minimum number of days that your employer has to give you paid time off for each year. In France, it's compulsory paid holiday. So whether you want to take that time off or not, you have to take that time off. And that's to avoid employers putting pressure on people to work on their day off or not request time off. But it's part of this whole very French attitude to work. It's a big deal for them. So it's part of national identity. You know, this is what makes them different from the Anglo-Saxon approach and the American approach. And the French, from their perspective, you know, they enjoy life, and they make sure their citizens that life isn't all in your identity, isn't all about your career, and you need to have time to spend with family and pursue leisure and enjoy hobbies. And I mean, and to be fair, yeah, there are damages to family that comes from workaholicism, and you know, there are definitely people that neglect their families by working a lot. I just find it a very heavy-handed bureaucratic way of dealing with that. They also have laws about employees not sending you emails after hours and this kind of thing. Anyway, this is now over. And because pension reform is such a big deal, this has implications far beyond just your typical changing of government policy. Le Figaro, the pro-business newspaper, it says France continues to believe in the old ideas that are leading it to ruin. Inoculated nearly 50 years ago, the socialist poison continues to wreak havoc. Patrick Martin, he runs France's biggest employer federation. He warned that postponing pension reform would be, quote, a terrible message to the financial market, signaling that France is unreformable. That is the big danger here. That, okay, it took Emmanuel Macron, and that's what made him stand out from Nicolas Sarkozy and François Hollande and these previous prime ministers, is he got pension reform done. And then they hit Control Z. You know, they undid it. And so is France reformable? Can France's economy be saved? You've had the last prime minister went out because he couldn't pass a budget to get France's economy under control. This next prime minister, he's managed to save himself for now by undoing pension reforms. So there are immediate questions of, okay, well, where's the money going to come to pay for this next year, the year after? Because it's pension reforms, this is a lot of this, it's large sums of money, but large sums of money in the medium term, a few years off. So it's not like this causes France a financial catastrophe today and that they've got this massive bill to pay tomorrow morning that they can't afford to pay. But it's this approach of, well, can France get control of its budget? And then investors, maybe more quickly than 4 or 5 years in some of these very big pension bills coming up, because it'll ramp up each year. Rather than waiting that time, you'll have investors saying, well, I don't think lending money to France is a good idea. And so actually I'll charge a higher interest rate. That's the real danger that France faces. And so this whole crisis has shown it's a government crisis and an economic crisis. There's a veteran political commentator, Alain Duhamel. He said, France has moved beyond a political crisis. I think it's a regime crisis. France is trapped between two systems. We have a president who behaves like a monarch, but depends on a parliament he does not control. The two halves of the machine are pulling in opposite directions. And he said, the French are always dissatisfied, and now they're more than dissatisfied. They are furious. That's that kind of stunt of firing Le Carnu and then rehiring him again. That did outrage a lot of people. Now, Le Carnu faced this week, I think Thursday, Friday, a couple of censorship motions where they could have, Parliament tried to vote him out of office. They fell 18 votes short of doing that. So he's in for now, but he's got a very short amount of time to get his budget for the next year through. They're very much not out of the woods yet. And all of this, as we've said before, really does put the focus on Germany, both practically, because when it comes to Europe spending more on its defense, standing on its own two feet, like, you know, that takes cash, and France just doesn't have the cash, and Germany does, and that's a major factor that sees Germany in the driving seat. Germany can say, "Hey, we've only borrowed 60% of our GDP, 60% of our annual economic output." We have space to borrow more. We have much more headroom on our credit card. We're not close to maxing that out. So let's do it. Another 100 billion on the defense. We can do that. When France's debt levels are double Germany's, they're in a very different position. So just even practically, that economic situation is putting Germany in the driver's seat. But then also it's very hard for France to act decisively on the world scene when they're so divided at home. So this puts the focus on Germany. But Germany, too, they had some government upsets over the time that we've been away. You had the German defense minister, Boris Pistorius, essentially torpedo his own bill to reintroduce conscription. Pistorius wanted to move, and his social democrats, kind of the left wing of the coalition, they wanted to move more slowly towards conscription. And so they want, as a first step, all men and any women who want to have to fill in a questionnaire that assesses their fitness for military service. And this was supposed to nudge young German men who had to fill in the questionnaire, optional for women, was supposed to nudge them towards signing up. But the Christian Democratic Union wanted something more forceful. They spoke to the leaders of the Social Democrats. They hammered out a kind of a compromise where if too few people volunteered for military service, there would be a lottery system and people would be selected at random until the shortfall was filled. Now, there would be another vote in Parliament before the lottery system kind of went into effect. It was a fairly complicated compromise. But one of the key things is they didn't run that compromise by Boris Pistorius, and he didn't like it. And so he kind of led a rebellion against his own bill and was threatening to vote that down. And now that's kind of back to the drawing board. Then also you have kind of a similar situation where this time it's the Social Democrats. One of the big things they want, again, is pension reform. And the coalition had agreed to kind of fix the state pension at, I think it was about 45% of average wages, so that as wages go up, the pensions would go up naturally. Social Democrats, though, in the actual pension laws, they got some more concessions. And again, party leaders had negotiated and okayed this, but 18 young members of the Bundestag from the Christian Democratic Union said, well, no, we don't want this. We'll vote against it. And this coalition, it's a left-right coalition, but they still don't have that big of a majority. And so they kind of are threatening now to torpedo that. Now, this isn't a France-level crisis for Germany. This isn't unprecedented. This isn't brand new political territory. I mean, we are kind of seeing that in France for the Fifth Republic. This is what happens in coalitions. But it is more signs of, hey, we're stuck in this system with unstable coalitions. And this is, you know, this has been par for the course for the last 10, 15 years. And it's just, well, we're still stuck in this situation where it's very hard for governments to get anything done. And it's exactly for this kind of reason that back in 2019, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry talked about a strong leader could take power, quote, take advantage of a weak coalition, that this could be a path to power for a strong leader. And I think Friedrich Merz he's a stronger leader than Olaf Scholz. This has been a more stable government, and it's a more accomplished government than Olaf Scholz. But this week's news is a reminder that Merz's power is still fundamentally based on a fragile coalition. But what we're watching for in Germany and in Europe is this shift towards a new kind of government. And what we're seeing in France, what we're seeing in Germany, they will lead to this. We're watching for the rise of a strong leader, prophesied in Daniel 8, Daniel 11, Revelation 13, Revelation 17. This strong leader is a major figure in Bible prophecy. Revelation 17 prophesies of a beast or an empire in biblical symbolism that rises and falls. And it's a beast that is led by a woman or a false church. And so one key leader and one key ingredient for this soon coming beast power, this resurrected Holy Roman Empire, is a religious leader. Elsewhere, he's called the false prophet. And they're very strongly influenced by a church. And it's a continuation of an empire that has risen and fallen before. You look through Revelation 17 and it makes that very clear. It talks about there are seven kings, five are fallen, five are in the past. One is, when this prophecy is revealed, there would be one on the scene, one is yet to come. So it comes one after the other. And this is very just basic logic based on the Bible. So where have you had an empire led by a church that's risen and fallen? Well, it's in Europe, and it's the Holy Roman Empire. So we're looking for religion to play a major role there. But there's also a strong man. And the Bible does this continually, where it will talk about a king and a kingdom interchangeably. The guy that leads the power and the power itself, they're kind of almost used interchangeably. And it's the same in Revelation 17 and elsewhere in the book of Revelation. We'll talk about the beast power as the empire. But it also talks about the beast as one individual, as a strong man. And it says that the 10 kings that make up this last resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, there'll be 10 leaders. They give their strength and their power to the beast, to this overall empire, and to this one leader that's going to lead them. And so it's because of this that Herbert W. Armstrong forecast this for years. He forecast the rise of this leader almost as soon as Germany was defeated in World War II. In 1950, he said that European nations are becoming distrustful of America and thinking more and more about uniting themselves into a United States of Europe. And he said that to do that, they needed a new supreme leader, the successor of Adolf Hitler, to rise up and assert himself and take command. 1953, it is probable that none but a German can provide the dynamic, inspired leadership required to organize such a political military federation. 1954, his plain truth said that Germany inevitably will emerge as the leader of a united Europe. It will require some spiritual binding force to inspire this confidence, to remove those fears, and the spiritual binding force must arise from in Europe. All Europe is actually ready, just waiting for the confidence-inspiring leader. That man is there somewhere. And then even his final year of his life, in 1985, Mr. Armstrong wrote, there is yet another leader to arise in Europe. And Mr. Flurry immediately picked up the baton. In 1991, one of the earliest trumpet print issues, he says, if a real crisis develops, will the Germans call for a new Führer, a new strongman? Your Bible says that is going to happen. That crisis will probably be triggered by an economic collapse in the United States. And I am seeing more and more headlines talking about an economic collapse. I want to get into that in a later program. And then the book of Daniel gives us more details about how this leader comes to power. Daniel chapter 11 and verse 21 says that he comes to power, or that he obtains the kingdom by flatteries. And you look at the original Hebrew and the commentaries that can help you understand that word and the original intent of what Daniel wrote there. And he doesn't come into power the way that kings normally come to power, or the standard way of acquiring power. And so coming with flatteries, well, coming through a weak coalition, that's one way that that could happen. So even in 2002, for example, Mr. Flurry wrote, this man doesn't come to power the honorable way by being voted into office. It doesn't say it says they don't confer on him the honor of the kingdom. He says he takes it dishonorably. He will work behind the scenes and come to power by flatteries, not votes. And so coalition chaos, that can provide an avenue for that to happen. So keep watching that in Germany too. I think what's happening in France shows the European-wide vacuum of leadership and of strongman type leadership. And Macron, he aspires to be a strongman. I think he would love to lead all of Europe. And maybe he will be. There's a good chance he could be one of the kings that's leading France. Mr. Flurry has been open to that possibility, or talked about that being a strong possibility. But not with France's current constitution and system of government and parliament. You're looking at a crisis and strongman taking power. But France doesn't have the foundation, the economic strength to dominate all of Europe, to be that leading strongman. Watch for a German to do that. And it's the same way in Germany. There are different coalition chaoses and problems. It's going to lead to a strongman and a fundamentally different government that's not all about democracy and the Bundestag and parliamentary negotiations, etc. And on that subject, we got some really interesting news from a man that Mr. Flurry has been focused on as really closely matching what the Bible talks about of this strongman and being a very strong candidate as the one who could be this strongman. And that is the former German defense minister, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. He, in many ways, looks like a has-been. He was the economics minister, he was the defense minister, he was thrown out on his ear over a plagiarism scandal over a decade ago. He has been out of politics. He says he has no interest in returning to politics. What I find fascinating, though, is how easily he makes the news. We saw this when he divorced from his wife, I think, a few years ago. His girlfriend was appointed to the economics ministry in the current government. And everyone kind of said, she only got the job because of her relationship with zu Guttenberg, which, I mean, kind of says a lot about zu Guttenberg's at least perceived power. I have no idea if that's true or not, by the way. I'm not throwing accusations at her, and I know no reality behind that. But the fact that people would make that statement shows that zu Guttenberg is still considered to be a powerful figure within German politics, that having a relationship with him could help your career. That's a little bit different from somebody who seems like a complete political has-been. And so this week, Stern magazine, they put out an interview with him and then a couple of other kind of veteran figures from Germany's mainstream right. And it was about how to deal with Germany's political problems and impasse. So you have in Germany, you have the center-right Christian Union parties. That's kind of Germany's equivalent of the Republicans. You have the Christian Democratic Union, and they run throughout most of Germany. And then you have the Christian Social Union, and they're kind of like the Bavarian branch of the CDU. It's not quite that simple. They're a bit more independent. Bavaria is basically Germany's Texas. They kind of like to think that they're their own country, and they do things differently or better depending on who you ask there. So the CSU run only in Bavaria, CDU run everywhere else, but they work together at elections. They agree on a single candidate for chancellor, etc. So these Christian Union parties, though, they have the same problem. How do you deal with the Alternative for Deutschland, the AfD, this party where some leaders, I think, are certainly neo-Nazi and have said neo-Nazi things, have said, well, Germany needs to celebrate its the achievements of its soldiers in World War II and things like that. And so how do you deal with that? And that's what Stern's interviews were all about. And these different leaders in their ways were open to doing business with the Alternative for Deutschland. And that is huge because for the longest time, the CDU's policy and the CSU's policy has been to erect a firewall. We're not going to have anything to do with the AfD. That's how we're going to deal with their rise. That causes problems, though, because if the AfD is starting to get 30% of the vote like they do in some parts of Eastern Germany, the only way that you can not vote with them is, or not work with them, is you have to work with the left. And in some cases, even the far left. You're starting to get to the point in East Germany where Die Linke, the East German Communist Party, the far left party, and the Alternative for Deutschland, this far right party, combined, they're getting 50% of the seats. Like, you literally can't exclude both of them because together they have a majority. So how do we deal with this? And these different leaders were basically open to different to some level of cooperation with the AfD. And that is huge news because of that change in policy. And people remember that it was compromising with the Nazis and saying, well, actually, we have to work with Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party in the early 1930s that then paved the way for him to take over. Now, Zu Gutenberg's comments were perhaps the mildest of the three. Basically, you know, he said, well, we should engage with them. We shouldn't just completely ignore them. You can't debate someone. You can't argue with their ideas. If you're going to persuade AfD voters, we need to be arguing and engaging with these leaders more publicly. Now, he still was very rude about the AfD leaders, and he basically called them idiots. You know, like, he's not an AfD fan. And he has previously been pretty critical of the AfD, and he continued that. But the big thing that kind of caused the firestorm of attention is Stern asked him, okay, well, what about in the Eastern German elections where you have to have a majority in the parliament to appoint a prime minister? How should the CDU have a minority government where they just rely on anyone for support? And he said, well, yeah, we do need to start looking at plan Bs. Obviously, we'd like to win the election, but if we don't, we should have plan Bs in place. And so this was seen, rightly, I think, as opening the door to not really necessarily doing business, but coming to power with the support of the AfD. It would not be a CDU-AfD coalition, and that would still be a taboo, but it would be a crack in the taboo, a crack in the dam, a crack in the firewall or a thin end of the wedge where the CDU has a minority government. They're not entering into talks necessarily with the Alternative for Deutschland. They're not doing deals with them, but they're saying, well, if the Alternative for Deutschland decided to vote for us, and if they, you know, if we were supporting this measure and they were supporting the same measure and we got it through due to their help, well, okay, we can, we'll do that. That's the kind of thing he's talking about. And he still had a lot of strong statements about not negotiating with neo-Nazis and not talking to them. But in that way, he opened the door to doing business with them. And that, like I said, was huge, huge news. So this is the man that Mr. Flurry has been watching and that we've been watching here at the Trumpet. And you know, here's an article, Watch This Man Closely, that we can put in the show notes that goes through exactly why we think this man could fulfill these strong man prophecies and all the different things that make him noteworthy. That's from the February 2024 Trumpet print edition. So, yeah, watch this man closely. And I think the fact that he's been catapulted back into the news, who knows where this is going to lead? And how the AfD could play into his rise. Certainly they've kind of gummed up German politics to the point where you are having more and more people saying, well, maybe we need just a strong man. Maybe we need to reform or change how we engage with the parliament or democracy, so that we don't have this paralysis. So watch for his rise. Watch for the rise of the strongman. That's the important takeaway from a lot of the news in Europe this week. There's one more story that I'll just mention quickly that's worth noting. Well, there's others, I'm sure, and I think we'll be even just catching up ourselves on the news as we get back into the swing of things. But NATO conducted their annual nuclear exercises while we were away. Steadfast Noon, that took place in the Netherlands, same place I was. I didn't see any of this, though not too surprising. 2,000 military personnel, 71 aircraft. So it's routine, but it's kind of like, well, yeah, we live in a world where nations routinely prepare for nuclear war. You had American F-35s, American surveillance and tanker aircraft. The German Air Force participated with 3 Tornado aircraft that are equipped to drop American nuclear bombs. And this is where this European power is leading. They are going to be using nuclear weapons, and we're seeing them practicing with nuclear bombs. America has loaned them. So, and we have an article, again, I could put in the show notes for Mr. Flurry, America's Naive Trust in Germany, that will have more on that. So there you go. You're all caught up from Europe. We'll go now to Jeremiah Jacques, and he'll give you the update from Asia as he gets back into our office in the United States and covers what's been going on there.
The big story for Asia is that Russia's armed forces have recently deployed additional North Korean soldiers to support Russian operations in Ukraine's Sumy region. That's according to Ukrainian intelligence reports that were published yesterday. And the reports say that these North Koreans are now helping the Russians with UAV reconnaissance and with identifying Ukrainian positions, and also with carrying out strikes using Russia's multiple launch rocket systems. So this appears to be the third wave of North Korean soldiers that have joined Russia in this war. At this point, it looks like as many as 16,000 North Koreans have fought under Russia's command, and this most recent deployment appears to be a more high-tech, more specialized group of North Korean units. So it is a significant contribution that North Korea is making to the war, and a more significant one all the time. And this, of course, comes as the United States is continuing its efforts to bring an end to this horrendous war. That was one of President Trump's campaign promises, and ever since he has returned to the White House, he's been working hard at it. And for the first several months of his term, Mr. Trump took a very conciliatory approach toward Russia, just trying to use what he generally brands as quite a warm personal relationship that he has with President Putin to convince Putin to be satisfied with the territory that he has claimed so far. But after that conciliatory approach failed, we saw a shift from President Trump just over the last month or so. He suddenly began to really call out Russia's role as instigator of the conflict and as perpetuator of the conflict, and he began supporting Ukraine more vocally. And President Trump even started to discuss selling Ukraine some of America's Tomahawk missiles. That would be a major development because it would enable Ukraine to strike targets deep inside of Russia, and it would really inflict some pain on the Russians and likely convince them that they need to conclude the war. So many analysts were optimistic that Mr. Trump was finally abandoning his sort of appeasement approach to Putin, and that he was finally realizing that his personal relationship with Putin was really just a ruse, and that the only language that the Russian leadership really speaks is the language of force. But then just yesterday, Vladimir Putin and President Trump had a phone call, and Putin flattered President Trump, and he waved a promise of some new historic meeting in front of his nose. And analysts were hoping that Mr. Trump would remember the recent summit in Alaska, which came to nothing and which just bought Russia more time. Analysts were hoping that Trump would remember the crazy Istanbul talks that happened a few months ago and how those only bought more time for Russia. But instead, Mr. Trump posted about this on social media yesterday, and his post shows that he thinks things will go differently this time. His post had a very enthusiastic reading of the call, just talking about how happy Mr. Trump was that Putin had praised him. And there was a lot of optimism there about this upcoming meeting that Mr. Trump and Putin planned to hold. And now President Trump says the tomahawks for Ukraine are off the table. So President Trump again seems to have kind of an excuse to give Putin more time. And at the same time, he's sort of preemptively boasting about these fantastic successes that he expects to come from the meeting. So it's a situation where some optimism had been building that some real pressure would finally come on Russia, but now it seems that those hopes are dashed. And even from this North Korean soldier story, we can see that Russia is not planning to stop this war, has no plans to stop the war. Putin currently is ramping up conscription efforts in Russia. This fall is a record draft. Putin is also aggressively recruiting hundreds of thousands of new contract soldiers right now. And then on top of all of that, we see these additional North Korean soldiers coming in as well. So it's clear that Vladimir Putin is not really thinking about peace, despite whatever he may say to President Trump. But this development with Russia and North Korea, it is something that the trumpet carefully watches. And that's because biblical prophecy tells us that a massive Asian alliance will soon come together. It's called the Kings of the East in Scripture. And the passages in the Bible make it clear that Russia and China will be the primary nations in this bloc, with Russia as the lead nation. But they show that it'll also include smaller Asian states as well, such as North Korea. That's what biblical prophecy shows. And so for us to be seeing Russia right now waging this brutal war, and to see China supporting Russia, and to see North Korea supporting Russia, and even sending soldiers there to fight alongside Russian soldiers, you can really see the groundwork being laid for this enormous Asian alliance to come together. And you can see some of the main players already making war together as allies. So it's very significant. And if anyone would like to understand the Bible passages about that, we have a free booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy that goes through them all with quite a lot of depth and detail. And this is a booklet that we send out for free. So once again, this is called Russia and China in Prophecy. And then I also wanted to talk about a smaller story about China's aggression. It was on October 12th that some Chinese Coast Guard and maritime militia vessels were bullying some Philippine boats near Pagasa Island in the West Philippine Sea. Most of them were firing water cannons, but one of the Chinese vessels, a Coast Guard ship, actually rammed into a Philippine boat. And this is significant because Pagasa lies well within the Philippines' exclusive economic zone as defined by international law, according to the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, and also reinforced by a landmark 2016 international court ruling. So that's what international law says. It says this is Philippine territory. But China rejects international law unless that is serving their purposes of the day. And China claims almost the entire South China Sea as its own, including much of the West Philippine Sea sections, which lawfully belong to the Philippines. And China also claims the sections that lawfully belong to Brunei, Malaysia, Taiwan, Indonesia, and Vietnam. And China enforces those claims in part by antagonizing the vessels of those other nations when they are in their own waters. So this ramming that happened on October 12th, it only caused minor damage, but it's only the latest instance of China's illegal and destabilizing aggression in one of the world's most important waterways and maritime regions. So this it is a flashpoint that we really need to keep a close eye on. And then one final story here about another Chinese ship. This one is not a Coast Guard vessel, but a massive container ship called Istanbul Bridge. And a few days ago, it completed a journey through the Arctic Sea route to the United Kingdom. So that is up the coast of China and then up past Russia's far east and then across the top of Russia for thousands of miles on this Arctic Sea route. And the remarkable thing is that this journey only took the Chinese vessel about 20 days. And if it had gone by the usual route through the Suez Canal, that would have been more like 40 days or 50 days that it would have taken to complete this. So this new Arctic Sea route is really slashing travel times for Chinese shipments to Europe. And that's why the Chinese and the Russians and even the Europeans are working hard to get this route fully established. This is going to dramatically streamline trade between Asia and Europe, and it's going to help pave the way for the two continents to build a mighty trade bloc that we expect, based on Bible prophecy, to really reshape so much of the global economy.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Thank you very much to you for joining us today with our kind of half panel, and we'll get the other half of the news caught up on Wednesday. Thank you to George Haddad for engineering and production, both this show and then especially last show, the show on the road that you helped put together for us while you were down under in Australia, jumping through all kinds of hoops to that get that done. We're really glad we didn't have to take an even longer hiatus. If you have any questions, any comments, please do get in touch, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. If you go to our website, thetrumpet.com, we have a lot of material. This is a news review show, and we cover things pretty briefly, but we would love for you to dig into the Bible to prove what we're saying on this show from your own Bible, to read it for yourself, to not trust me or Jeremiah. Trust your Bible and study your Bible. Build your own relationship with God, and we have books that can help you do that. You know, we have books on how to pray, how to form that personal relationship with God, and we have books on things like Who or What is the Prophetic Beast or Russia and China in Prophecy that will help you prove and will show you the scriptures so you can turn to them in your own Bible and help you prove what we're saying about what we're seeing happen in Europe, in Asia, and all around the world. So you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. We'll be back with another update on Wednesday. Until then, keep watching your world.